Welcome to the Conservative Thought Hour, where America always comes first.
I'm proud to be an American.
Each week, we bring you captivating guests who will speak on many topics of national interest. We are not interested in telling you what to think or how to think. We have faith that you can do that for yourself. Our interest is to bring you information to help you form your own opinions. As always, the views expressed by our guests are their own and are not necessarily shared by the host or the station you are listening to. Get ready for enlightenment with the Conservative Thought Hour.
With all due respect, sir, I believe this is going to be our finest hour.
And now, here are your hosts, Carrie Black and Rick Stannard.
And welcome to another hour of enlightenment with the Conservative Thought Hour. You can hear it here every Saturday morning from 9 to 10. Happy Saturday morning to you, Rick. Carrie Black along with you with political activist Rick Stannard. Good morning, Rick.
Good morning, Gary.
You are bright and bushy-tailed, my friend. I like it. We've got a very special guest today. John O'Connor joins us this morning, the author of Postgate, How the Washington Post Betrayed Deep Throat, Covered Up Watergate, and Began Today's Partisan Advocacy Journalism, and host of the Mysteries of Watergate podcast. He also served as an assistant U.S. attorney in Northern California, representing the United States in both criminal and civil cases. And he sounds like he's in a jungle. Good morning, John.
Well, I'll get out of my jungle. I have a birthday here, and someone decided to start playing the guitar, so maybe that stopped. Anyway, let's continue on and hope if it continues, I'll move to another spot here. But my little grandson loves Johnny Cash, and one of the fellows here can play guitar, so he just got out. It's early in the morning here, but he was playing Johnny Cash for my grandson. So there we are.
That's wonderful.
We're having some fun.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for joining us, John.
Sure. And I hope this is good. Yeah.
Yeah, we'll get to Postgate in a minute, but I want to first talk to you about the indictments that New York City is bringing down against Trump and or his organization. I know you've not anything to do with it other than being an interested observer from a legal standpoint. And there seems to be two different storylines here, one saying there will be indictments, one from Trump's lawyer saying there will not be an indictment against Trump. What's going on and what's going to happen?
Well, there will be indictments. It'll be against probably maybe a couple people, but certainly it'll be against Alan Weisselberg, the CFO of the Trump Organization, who wrote checks on the Trump Organization's account to pay for his tuition for his kids to school and some other things. And also for his son. Now, his son may get indicted, who was with the Trump Organization also. There's also a guy named Matt Calamari, who's in the organization, who did the same thing. So they're probably going to indict them on charges of tax evasion because they did that. They wrote those checks with the intent not to pay taxes on them and to sort of shield them from scrutiny. The writing the checks for the tuition, I suppose, there's nothing wrong with it if it's a private organization and the organization says that's fine, you know. But on the other hand, it is not okay, of course, to take that money and then not report it for tax purposes. And so that's what really happened. I'm trying to move right portion of this to a place. So I'm sorry. I think I can do it. Let me try. But anyway, I'm in Napa Valley right now. There's a little celebratory vibe going on here, and I'm trying to avoid the celebrations. It's normally quiet here. Okay. But anyway, so what's happening is at least two or three people will get indicted. But it's very simple, basic tax evasion. And you know, it's really nothing to get alarmed at. And I'm thinking of the Peggy Lee song from the 50s. Is that all there is? We have all this hubbub about getting Trump's tax returns and so forth. And this is all they can come up with.
Well, this has been going on for 2 years.
Right. And so there's really nothing to it. They may try to indict the Trump Organization, which prosecutors sometimes will indict a corporation. For instance, a corporation is polluting, and it's a company-wide practice. You indict the corporation. You may indict some individuals as well, but you indict the corporation. Often is done. In this case, they may try to indict the Trump Organization just because that would seem more harming to Trump. They're really just trying to harm Trump. The real indictment here should be against the individuals. So some individuals are not paying taxes and are doing things to not pay taxes. Okay, fine. But, you know, you don't necessarily indict the organization. But it's really a tempest in a teapot. What's going to happen here is, though, the judge, they may try to get a judge who is going to throw the book at these guys because they got them. I mean, I'm pretty sure they're guilty. I don't think they paid taxes. I think they knew exactly why they were doing it. Alan Weisselberg, the CFO for 50 years of the Trump Organization, knows what the tax laws are, knows exactly what he was doing. They're going to try to get Weisselberg to roll over on Donald Trump and try to say he knew about this. And if you get a court that will sentence Weisselberg to a stiff amount and say, well, gee whiz, Mr. Weisselberg, if you cooperate, I'll cut it down. So now is Weisselberg going to do that? One of the reasons I don't think he will, even if he were so inclined, would be that he's got a son with the organization also, I believe. Now, the son has an ex-wife who I think is willing to tell tales, but I still don't think there's enough there to get at Trump. So that's, it's really not much of anything, and it just sort of shows you, if you indicted everyone who used funds from a private organization in a way to avoid taxes, for instance, paying for a personal vacation and saying it's a business trip, there wouldn't be enough jails in the entire world to house those people. We'd have to, basically give everybody house arrest. You know, let's have house arrest for the entire United States of America. So I don't mean to minimize it. I think people should pay their taxes, but you can. And if something like this were to have popped up naturally in the course of an investigation, yes, Weisselberg should be indicted. But this didn't come up that way. It came up because there was just a search for a crime, a dragnet for a crime, and that's what's offensive about this whole thing. Because the Supreme Court has chiseled on its stone face, equal justice under the law. Well, I don't think this is equal justice under the law. The prosecutors are using their discretion in a very discriminatory and biased way. They're not doing this to anybody else. They're not doing it to any Democrats. So you don't think they can't get Cuomo or somebody else for using for doing this kind of stuff? Of course they could do that. So It's a shame that this is our country has become so polarized, and especially I would say on the left. I don't think you see conservative people doing this. I just don't think the traditional people, I'll call them conservative, but they're really classical liberals, mainstream conservatives, are not doing this kind of stuff. It's all the progressives, and it all gets back to socialist authoritarian models, which seem to say that one side is inherently evil. So that's really the source of it all.
Well, this is just one, attorney general in New York City who's trying to make a name for herself. That's all this is.
Right. And also you have the local guy, Cyrus Vance. Yeah, that's all it is. And especially her. She's the one with political ambition, so she'll get her pound of flesh. I don't think it's going to go any further than that, frankly.
Now, John, you mentioned that some of the Trump Organization individuals could possibly be indicted. What for, and how strong do you feel the cases would be?
Well, they probably have them. I mean, I think, like I say, Matt Calamari, perhaps Weisselberg's son, as I understand it, were doing the same thing, that is to say, paying for private expenses like tuitions, perhaps some housing expense out of Trump Organization funds without denoting them on a 1099 or anything like that, so that the government would have no idea that these people were really getting compensation in the way of these payments to other entities. So there could be a couple more besides Alan Weisselberg, indicted, but that's what it would be for. Now, there was an investigation. I'll tell you how petty this got. But Trump had bought a property, and then he it did not work as a golf course. So then he said, okay, I'll donate the development rights into one of these land trusts, and for which you can get a deduction. In other words, you have a big piece of land that you could put a big housing development on, and you say, okay, I'm going to put a conservation easement on it that it cannot be developed. Well, you get a tax deduction because you're donating an interest in property. Mm-hmm. Well, Trump aggressively, the organization aggressively valued what he gave by way of charitable deductions, and they were looking at that, and they thought, aha, we'll get him here. And, of course, what Trump did was within the law. He had people appraised interest, and he, guess what? His appraisal was higher than the government's, okay? So, big deal.
Yeah, it's not against the law.
On that.
It's not against the law to be aggressive in your tax preparation.
Right.
That's right. It's called tax avoidance, not tax evasion. And that's what you should do. I was a government prosecutor, and we always said that tax avoidance is fine. Tax evasion is not. This is not tax evasion. Now, the payments to the I grant you that the payments to the private schools through the Trump Organization payments, Weisselberg probably, I'm just going to guess that there's a good chance that he evaded taxes there. That's all I'll say. But on the other hand, it is relatively petty stuff. And is it stuff that, as a prosecutor, I would expect any more than 3 months in prison? No. But they're going to try to get him. I bet you they're going to ask for 8 years of a sentence and so forth and so on. And then try to get him to roll over.
Yeah. Well, we use the term Trump Organization relatively loosely. Trump has a lot of organizations. What exactly are we talking about when we say the Trump Organization?
Well, they actually use that term, and it is a term that does encompass an awful lot of subsidiaries. Of course, real estate developers will have, entity on entity on entity, owning this, owning that, limited partnerships. So it's an overall group of organizations, really, is what it is. But they do call themselves the capital T Trump, capital O organization. Is there actually a Trump organization? I'm not so sure about that. It's sort of a it's a DBA. It's a name of a business,
yeah.
Is what it is, and it's operating as a business. So, yeah, I mean, there are a lot of real estate entities that are like that have this broad name, but when you look at the structure of their deals, there are so many layers of LLCs and corporations and limited partnerships, your head spins.
Yeah, there are enough corporate veils to take an attorney a lifetime to pierce.
That's right. That's right. That's what we do for a living. We pierce those veils or keep them from being pierced. So, yeah.
Yeah. Tell me, John, are there any indictments that were anticipated that will not result in charges? I mean, was there anything that the Trump Organization, in quotes, was afraid of that didn't happen?
Well, not really. I mean, I think it's this kind of stuff like the valuation of what I think it was the Seven Springs Resort, something like that, the one I was talking about earlier. But all it is petty fly-specking of tax returns. That's what they were doing. They're trying to get. And, you know, Michael Cohen had testified about, oh, he values, you know, things low for tax purposes and high for bank purposes. And people went, gasp, that's terrible. Well, actually, you're supposed to do that. The government, when you do your amortization and depreciation, you're supposed to have a low value. You're not supposed to depreciate some value that's a pie in the sky, because that's a benefit to you to depreciate a large amount. So you're supposed to value your property at cost to depreciate it. So that's what he did for taxes. And then when the bank asks you for how much you're worth, you're supposed to value at market value. Now, Now, Cohen was not sophisticated enough to understand that, but there's no crime in that. That's what you're supposed to do. The bank wants the current value of things, high or low, and the government has a different standard. You look at cost, but that's the kind of thing they were looking at, and it's really sort of very unsophisticated but very aggressive and partisan view of things. And I suspect that Letitia James and Cyrus Vance, that neither of them are exactly Einsteins.
Well, you know, we'd be in the same position and a lot cheaper if they had just turned over this information to the IRS.
That's right. That's right. And the IRS, and the other thing about it is that people forget that with a company this big, you know, they get audited constantly. That you're not going to take someone that puts hundreds of millions through their accounts every year and just let them go. They're constantly going to be audited. And so the IRS, the thing is, this organization has passed muster every year. And then, you know, to the extent somebody disputes as to whether something should be depreciated or expensed, then you figure it out and you come to resolutions, and sometimes there's a payment of additional taxes and you rejigger mm-hmm. the thing around. But that's common.
Yeah.
And that's what they do every year, and that's what's so silly about this whole thing, because he has passed a review by very professional people. And now you get these people, like they say, I bet you if you gave Letitia James a tax exam, she'd fail it. You know, it's a complex thing. It takes some brains. I took a couple of years of tax in law school, and I'll tell you, it's, you know, it can bend your mind, you know. And so I just don't think these people even know what they're doing. And they're out there just trying to get Trump. And
yeah.
There we are.
Well, from everything you've said, I just don't see where they're going to be able to even sneeze at Trump.
Well, they're not. I don't think they are going to do much to him, and I think this is their last gasp. I think you know, there'll still be people looking, but if they can't get anything now on Trump, what are they going to get? I mean, it's so they apparently also were looking at these payments to the girls that the women that Trump paid off, and you know, those apparently passed muster as being, you know, a legitimate business expenses. If today I were in a corporation and somebody accused me of sexual harassment and I settled, you know, that's a legitimate business expense, happens every day. I've settled. I've not gone my own. I mean, I've sued people and I've defended companies on these things, and those are legitimate business expenses.
You're not volunteering personal actions here, are you?
I'm not. I have not been a defendant in one of these cases. Thank you very much. But it would be if I were hypothetically, I would deduct a payment as a business expense if I did it in the course and scope of employment. Yeah.
Well, I saw where a former impeachment lawyer going by the name of Daniel Goldman was actually probably putting himself up for the Michael Avenatti Award as the dumbest attorney in history. And he said these indictments will spell the end of the Trump Organization. I take it you do not agree with him.
Mm.
Yes, I do not agree that a bank, his theory was that all the lenders are going to call all their loans because Alan Weisselberg got indicted for paying a tuition to a school. I don't think so. You know, as I say, I was a prosecutor and we would indict some larger corporations, and that's usually who gets indicted in the corporate sense. And we're not even sure the Trump Organization would get indicted here. But even if it did, is this going to cause someone to call a loan? I don't think so. You know, I suppose if they got socked with a $1 billion fine, I'm just making that up, some ridiculous fine, I suppose that would concern a lender and they would, you know, deem themselves insecure and so forth and so on. But you know, that's really just hyperbole, everyone wants to announce the doom of Trump, and this isn't going to happen. I mean, it's once again absurdity. It's people are wishing for these things. And as long as you say something like that, like Goldman is doing, you're on the right side. You're on the side of the angels. So when you turn out to be terribly wrong, nobody's going to come back at you. You notice that nobody is coming back on the progressive side of things and saying, you know, this is really terrible about this Russian collusion investigation. Oh, we were wrong about the Duke. Or we're wrong about the Duke lacrosse players. We are very apologetic. You don't hear the apologies, do you?
No, you don't. Mm-mm. We are speaking with Deep Throat's lawyer. We're talking with John O'Connor this morning in the Conservative Thought Hour. Thank you so much for being a part of it. And author of Postgate. So can we move real quickly to Watergate happened 50 years ago. Obviously, you believe it's still relevant, John. Why is it important today? And what do you want our listeners to learn from reading your new book that's out? Tell us about the book, too.
Well, Postgate is the book, and really what's happened is with Watergate, the post-journalism gave the media its authority, its imprimatur, its crown of legitimacy. We got rid of a president of the United States because we're such great investigative reporters. Now, And since then, of course, that's where investigative journalism has gone, because the press realizes it has power. It can make or break a king. So it exercises that power. When you do that, you necessarily join a team. And that's what happened. Investigative journalists, young people went to school to, quote, change the world, unquote. If you're going to do that, you need to be on a team. And, of course, changing the world usually means slaying conservatives. And that's what happened here. But think about it. If now the foundation for all these gates, remember, every scandal is a gate reminiscent of Watergate. Oh, gosh, is this worse than Watergate? Let's call on Carl Bernstein. Well, if Watergate itself was a fraud brought forth by journalists, I'm not saying Nixon was not guilty of certain crimes, but the whole scandal was misreported fraudulently by the Post. And if it is a fraudulent report, and if a president was driven from office fraudulently and deceitfully, what does that say about our press? If that is recognized by the conservative world, things go back to balance. When the jackals get out there and start going after one more conservative person, the answer is, you guys did this in Watergate, it was a fraud in Watergate, and you're doing it again today. When Trump got into office, there were several people in journalism school, and I know this is a fact, but certain deans and professors were saying, let's Watergate Trump, Watergate being a verb. And that's what they tried to do with massive publicity and so forth. And, you know, he was an inch away from getting Watergated, because even though the investigation was silly, if Trump would have done something to obstruct it, they would have gotten him and everybody would have cheered. So Watergate is the foundation. Watergate journalism is the foundation for what the media is doing today. And if that is shown to be fraudulent, the whole house of cards comes down. That's why every conservative needs to read Postgate. Now, the Post and MSNBC and so forth are not going to say a word about my book for obvious reasons. Mm-hmm. So that's what it is. It's the foundation for what's going on today in our fraudulent media.
Good. Well, I want all the listeners to know that when we're talking about Watergate, we are speaking to the horse's mouth.
Mm-hmm.
John was the attorney for Deep Throat. He knows everything there is to know about Watergate. Where can we get this book, John?
Well, Amazon is a good place to start, and also my book site, postgatebook.com, will give all the reviews and different things that have been written about it. So I would go to Amazon or to postgatebook.com.
Well, I have to tell you, I read the book yesterday, and it is, for me, it was a page-turner, and I thought I knew what Watergate was about. And boy, did you open my eyes.
Well, there are two things here. Number one, Watergate isn't about what they said it was about. And then secondly, the Post knew it. It's one thing to make a legitimate mistake because everybody's lying about this thing. And so, sure, maybe the Post got it wrong unintentionally. But part of my book is that I discovered that they were quite intentional in their fraud, and I prove it. And So it's interesting to know, first of all, what really happened and how intriguing it was, and then what the Post did to hide it. And it's really, what gets me is it really took a lot of effort. This is not just one day in which a reporter decides to slapdash an article and omits a fact that he doesn't like. This is something that went on for 2 years. And then they persisted after the scandal to keep defending themselves and slaying all enemies who might suggest otherwise. So this book is irrefutable. There's no way that they can come in and fight this. So they're trying to ignore it. They're trying to do the cancel culture deal. But the conservatives who read it know, as you say, you know, that I've got the goods on them.
Well, John, Mark Felt, who was high up in the FBI, was Deep Throat, and you were his mm-hmm. lawyer.
Right. Not during Watergate. I was in as his lawyer right. later on.
In 2002. Oh,
yeah. Right, exactly.
He must have been an incredibly interesting person because your book makes your heart ache for him.
Well, that's right. And during Watergate, he was an extremely clever guy. He just tried to do his job and keep Watergate open. He wasn't trying to get Nixon, but he tried to keep the investigation from being limited. And at the same time, he tried to fight our country's enemies, foreign enemies, doing what today we call FISA searches. FISA was invented because of Mark Felt, because Mark Felt was indicted for what were legitimate FISA searches against the PLO, who had just killed people in Munich, and the Weather Underground, which had bombed 50 buildings. So some Red Hots decided to indict Mark Felt for this, which were perfectly legitimate national security searches. And guess what? Who was the cheerleader that cheerled for the indictment of Mark Felt, who was a loyal public servant for over 30 years? The Washington Post. Hmm. The Washington Post was the cheerleader for his indictment. Doesn't that get you? Because it seemed like a really good way to skewer conservatives to say that, oh, these FBI agents are doing these terrible things. Well, guess what? He probably saved thousands of lives. The PLO, after Munich, had come over to New York City, and they were going to basically plan on slaughtering people, mainly Jews, and were, for instance, Jewish airliners on trips to Israel. They were going to blow them out of the sky. Well, Mark Felt did some FISA searches, found the names of these guys, had his agents visit the PLO members at 6 o'clock in the morning quite frequently and ask them what they were up to, and pretty soon these guys got the message and left the country. So he did a great service for us. He exhaustively searched for the Weather Underground people, did not find them in time. But nonetheless, that supposedly was what he did wrong. So he's a wonderful guy. He was very clever and did nothing but tell the truth. And one of the things I point out here is that he was all over the fact that the CIA was a very big player in Watergate, and yet guess our friends at the Post hid that and did not, convey that insight of its major source, who never steered them wrong, and yet they wouldn't publish that. For your listeners, everyone who knows anything about the Watergate, either the book or the movie, knows that one of the most dramatic scenes in All the President's Men is Deep Throat coming into the garage, his lip quivering, saying everyone's life's in danger. Woodward and Bernstein, hush, hush, go to Ben Bradley's house, and they talk in the middle of the yard so that no one can overhear him. And then in the book and the movie, they basically say, well, nothing really happened. It was a false alarm. Well, it wasn't a false alarm. It wasn't a false alarm. The CIA was threatening lives if their role was uncovered. And the Post printed nothing about Deep Throat's warning that the CIA was threatening lives because their role might be uncovered. Do you think that might be newsworthy? Now, when Woodward and Bernstein are doing the movie and doing their book, well, all of a sudden, this incident is newsworthy, is intriguing, is going to sell books and movies. So they put it in there, although they do it in such a way to sort of not really let the public know what this was really about. They try to give you the intrigue without the information. But this is just another example of the things that they want. So when I say they betrayed Deep Throat, they not only did so personally, but they betrayed the information he gave them and did not publish it all.
Wow. Well, it must have been incredibly difficult for Mark. Here's a lifelong FBI employee who loves the agency dearly, and yet he does things that would have gotten him in a lot of trouble. So he had to really be driven by something that few of us will ever feel.
Well, that's right. He was raised by some very religious parents who were very nice and sweet, very religious, and he said, I'd rather have my father whip me 10 times than have my mother say she was disappointed in me. He was a very moral man. And what's so terrible about this is when he got prosecuted and his wife came to court the first day and heard the prosecutors talk about him as a criminal, she was a very nervous woman. Mark was a very smooth guy. She started going downhill, and I interviewed all her friends. She started drinking. She started getting into pills. She was so depressed by what was happening to Mark. And after he retired one day, he went out to the store and came back, and his wife had shot herself. So I say, and he kept that hush-hush from his family. But basically, his wife... The country took from him his wife, and a lot of that comes from the Washington Post, who cheerled for his indictment. And it's a terrible, tragic thing. The guy endured so much for his country, and, you know, he gets treated shabbily for it, and it's just a shame. But to his credit, he stayed mellow, positive, patriotic to the end, and I knew him in his last 6 years of his life, 7 years of his life. And he was just a great guy, and he loved to sing God Bless America with his family, and he just loved the FBI and loved to talk about the good guys in law enforcement. And he was really a wonderful, sweet man. He used to sit in his little apartment with a painting of his wife above him, this beautiful picture of her. She was a lovely lady. And so he was just a very kind man. He moved to California, and the way I got to know him, he lived right near me. I didn't know that, but he came to California to help out his daughter, whose husband was no longer around, help him raise the children while she worked. He's just a kind, gentle man. Well, and
in your book, John, you started with a full respect for Bob Woodward. But as I read through the book, that respect seems to dissipate. Tell us about the transition and how you now view Bob Woodward.
Well, I always considered that the height of investigative journalism, along with white-collar criminal prosecution, was the marriage, so to speak, of Deep Throat in the Washington Post. I always knew Deep Throat was Mark Felt. I'd figured that out back in 76. And I thought this was the, if you want to say, apogee of reporting as an aid to fighting white-collar crime. And I saw this as just being wonderful journalism. And everything from that, I felt, was just a come-down. And I always thought, why can't we have reporting like Watergate? Because all the other reporting today is so terrible. Where did we go wrong here? Where did we go off this beautiful gold standard? And then, of course, as I look into it, I realize that, wait a second, this terrible reporting was not an exception to Watergate. It was caused by Watergate. It was caused by what the Post did. I don't think every reporter knows that the Washington Post committed fraud, but they do know that the Washington Post became that a reporter could become wealthy and powerful if they just took sides and they slanted their reporting. And so that's sort of what Watergate gave to the world. Now, many reporters don't think slanting news is fraud, but if you slant it enough, it becomes fraudulent. It's one thing to have an op-ed or an opinion that goes one way or the other. We all know that. But if I tell you that you can hit water on my back 40 at 20 feet, and so you say, that's great, I'm going to buy your property, and I neglect to tell you that it's got toxins in the water, I've defrauded you. And so when you leave out a material fact in your reporting and you say some other things that bear on the same subject, you're committing fraud. You're defrauding the reader. And you've got a sacred trust there as a reporter, especially of national scope.
Yes.
And I found that that's what the Washington Post was doing. They're reporting fact A without giving facts B and C, which would have changed the meaning of fact A, even if fact A was technically correct. And so all along, we've been told that Watergate was about a bungled campaign operation. And I'm here to tell you, absolutely, unequivocally, it had nothing to do with the campaign. If it had nothing to do with the campaign, Nixon and his inner circles would not have had any interest in it, correct?
Correct.
So what we have is we have the CIA in line with a couple younger White House lieutenants who wanted to do some stuff to burnish their own reputations and their own portfolios, sort of a silly venture. And so Nixon legitimately did not know what had happened. And so that's what's so terrible about it.
Wow. So you're saying that some White House operatives were in concert with the CIA?
I say that one again, yes, there were operatives that, now they didn't know, I'm not so sure how much the White House lieutenants knew that the people they were dealing with were the CIA. They knew that there was these operatives, but that was about it.
Yeah. Mark viewed the Deep Throat had assiduously stayed in the shadows, unknown to the world in general. You're the guy who convinced him to come out. How did you do that? And did you think it would benefit him or the country for his truth to be made public?
You're talking, and I'm sorry, I missed you a bit there, about the Deep Throat, you say?
Yes, Mark. He had stayed in shadows, and you convinced him to come out.
Well, that's right. And I convinced him to come out because one of the things I said to him, you know, if you don't come out while you're alive, and I know you want to protect the FBI and you don't want anybody thinking FBI agent went down to the garage, Mark, but if you don't come out now, the way you're going to get characterized, you have no control over. Woodward's going to do it. And the more I convinced them that Woodward, by the way, was breaching his promise by identifying Mark after his death, but what's Mark going to do about it? He's going to be dead. You know, can't sue anyway. So I said, you better come out and tell your own story your own way, and that's what we did. So once again, he was forced to do this. He would just as soon have died, you know, without anybody knowing what he did. But he also wished that no one would have come out and publicized this whole Deep Throat thing. That was really not intended either. So at the end of the day, he was a happy man because he realized that most people in the country realized that he was heroic and what he did was appropriate. He was not doing anything wrong. He was, in fact, he steadfastly refused to give Woodward and Bernstein actual files or actual reports. He tried to guide them. And that's why I knew it was a principled law enforcement officer, because he was guiding the reporters. He was not giving them confidential information. He was not doing that. And he said, basically, look, I'll teach you to fish, but I'm not going to give you fish. You go do it the right way. And guess what? So basically, Woodward and Bernstein just tailgated on the FBI. They'd follow their agents around and interview the same people. But everything he did was proper and heroic, and he mainly did it to keep the White House from restricting his investigation. He didn't. All he wanted to do was avoid any charges that the FBI was not doing a bang-up job. Now, I don't think Felt knew how explosive everything would eventually become.
Right.
So he didn't expect to get, and he wasn't trying to get rid of Nixon. He actually liked Nixon. He told me that in his later years, that he wasn't out to get Nixon.
Right.
Just so happened that way. And of course, some of getting Nixon was accomplished by the Washington Post. So Felt also didn't realize how deceitful the Post would be.
Mm-hmm. Well, John, how old was Mark when he passed away? How long did he live?
Boy, he lived till he was, I'm going to say, 94.
Wow.
Something like that.
Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. He had quite a good life. He really did. Mm-hmm. He might even been 95 there. But he had a good one. And he was sharp to the end. He had dementia in terms of vascular dementia in the sense that he could not remember in the past, but he was with it. He could be very intelligent in the moment. And so he truly appreciated when he would hear a TV show talk about Watergate. He grasped it in the moment. It's what we call executive memory. We can all remember for 30 minutes or so. And, then we can't remember where we put our car keys, you know. So we all have that issue after
my glasses,
40 years old. That's right. That's right. We all have that. And that's what he had probably as an older guy.
Yeah. Well, John, there have been a number of movies made about Watergate, including the Academy Award winner, All the President's Men, in 1976 with Redford and Hoffman. Are any of the movies close to the real story?
Well, they are in this sense. Their portrayal of Deep Throat is very good in All the President's Men. That is to say, what his manner was like, what he looked like. He looked like Hal Holbrook. He had that speaking style. And I think All the President's Men is actually a very good movie because it captures the excitement of the journalism. What it doesn't do is it just sort of makes sort of a one-note evil, good versus evil type of thing, that everybody in the White House is evil and everybody in the Washington Post press room are just these eager guys who roll up their sleeves and they're wonderful people. So it's a bit of a Hollywood portrayal. I think it's a great movie. It's one of the best I've seen. And but does it accurately portray Watergate? Yeah, in some ways yes, and in some ways no. It's about journalism and the excitement of journalism. It's wonderful, and it inspired an awful lot of young people to go into it. Unfortunately, they did not go into it with the right attitude, precisely because of the fame and glory. Now, Matt Taibbi is a journalist who's as left as you can be. He used to write for the Rolling Stone. He's a very brilliant guy, very, very left. And he says, you know, the terrible thing about Watergate was that these new journalists who came out, the young people who wanted to be journalists, they all wanted to be behind the velvet rope. They weren't just like Jimmy Breslin type of people out there trying to just tell it like it is, with a distrust of all people in authority. No, these are people who wanted to be behind the velvet rope and chum up with some people in authority and be their partisan dogs, so to speak. And that's really what happened. Oh, we're so cool. We're great investigative journalists, and they want nothing more than to, as Woodward did, go to Hyannisport and have drinks with the Kennedys. That's the sort of the goal. You know, and unfortunately, that's what it's gotten to be. And aren't we all cool? We're all on the same side. We're all getting rid of Trump or whatever we're doing at the time. And there's this in-group phenomenon about it. It's really very junior high-ish. It's like there's cool kids and there's kids that we can go pick on. And that's what they're doing. And it's really... you cannot have a democracy when you have a media like this. There's just no doubt about it. The democracy thrives on truthful reporting. And our founding fathers thought that the free press was an antidote to factionalism. But liberty generally encourages factionalism. James Madison, it was like oxygen to a fire. You give people liberty, there's going to be mobs, there's going to be factions. And the way we're going to cure this with a vigorous free press that's going to tell the facts to everyone. And I agree with all of that, you know, but instead what happens is our mainstream media today are the mob, are the biggest factions. They're leading the charge. They're leading factions. They're trying to create factions. You cannot watch CNN or MSNBC during the Trump years without saying these people are creating factions. They're creating, they're trying to create eyeballs and so forth for and viewers. In so doing, they're creating and trumping up, excuse the pun, issues. And they are the factionalists. They're the mob. And what are we doing with, we talked about Letitia James. That's mob stuff. That's a form of lynching. Let's just go out and get them. Oh, boy, let's raid Roger Stone at 6 in the morning, you know, a 68-year-old man and his wife. Just, do you need to do that? Come on now. I'm a prosecutor. When you prosecute a white-collar crime like Roger Stone or Paul Manafort, you send a letter to the lawyer saying, hey, when are you going to turn yourself in, you know? Mm-hmm. And let's do this quietly. Let's not make a big deal about it and turn yourself in. And but that's not what they're doing. This is a sort of it is. There's a lot of mob tarring and feathering that's going on here.
Yeah, it's true, Johnny. You know what? I might go out on a limb. I miss the old Walter Cronkite days when they reported the news and we got to decide.
We got to decide. And Walter Cronkite was about as lefty as you could be.
Yep.
You wouldn't know it because he was a principled man. And in those days, and I think that the stations realized that they could not turn off half the country by being a partisan. And that's part of their motive. That look, we want everyone to watch our newscasts, and we want to have credibility, too. But that all went, and I think one of the problems is the notion that you can make money through fractionalization, so to speak. And now once we have, you know, 300 channels, I suppose there's you can make money, I suppose, by getting a certain sector of the eyeballs onto your show. And maybe our present media configuration makes it even more attractive than in 1972 to bias the news. And that's the now the problem is you live by the sword, you die by the sword. CNN, as soon as Trump is out of the limelight, their viewership plummeted by 60% or some such, and that's the issue also. So they need to constantly sort of refurbish things to try to create the next scandal, but it's just not any way for any of us to live. I can't tell you how many people I know say, look, I can't do this anymore. I can't watch the news. And that's because we're not being factual. This should be something where people are of good faith and goodwill who have different beliefs can discuss things in a calm way and actually maybe even modify our own opinions. Gosh, you know something? I may actually be wrong or too extreme on one of my opinions. I may be wrong, and I don't mind somebody telling me that and explaining it to me. That's where we get better with democracy. But now the whole democratic process that, you know, de Tocqueville talked about so much, about people getting together and talking to each other, we don't have that in America anymore, and it's because of the media. Yep. And we cannot have democracy if we can't have this kind of discussion at the local level, in our media, and so forth. So and I think if we all raise our voices enough in a principled way, and we say we're not going to take these lies that and this slanting that the mainstream media is doing, I think eventually economic factors will win out for, and I say conservative, you know, when I've talked about conservatives, I'm talking about mainstream conservatives and classical liberals, not anybody that's, it's really the middle of the pack. You know, most people I know that are so-called conservatives, I mean, would be, in 1940, would be considered liberal. It's just very mainstream enlightenment thought, free markets, free discussion, free exercise of religion, free contract. And that's what people want. They want fairness, and we're not getting it.
I absolutely wish we could go on for another hour or two, but we cannot. We're running out of time. I want to thank you, John O'Connor, for your time and your knowledge and your wonderful wisdom in helping us understand Watergate and how it still drives our world today.
Amazing.
It really does. And it's great talking to you all, and it's great to have a show in which people actually discuss things for longer than 30 seconds. So that's what's great about your program.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, John. That's great. John O'Connor. And again, tell our listeners where they can find your book, Postgate.
Well, I would go on to postgatebook.com for the book, and you can also click on to my The Mysteries of Watergate podcast, which will tell you all about Watergate, too. It's very intriguing. The book is a much more detailed explication of the post-fraud, and the podcast gets you into some of the intriguing details about the scandal.
All right, John, thank you so much for being with us. We'll have you on again soon.
Great talking to you. Take care now.
And a big thank you for listening to another hour of the Conservative Thought Hour. We're here every Saturday from 9 until 10.
Thank you for listening to the Conservative Thought Hour. Remember what Albert Einstein said. The world is a very dangerous place, not because of the evil men in it, but because of the good men who do nothing.